Blues with the feeling is good for your heart. I'm no doctor, but I have a prescription for the blues. Keep it locked to WHFR, the only station making waves. Hi, I'm Anderson Coleman. Listen to me every Saturday on 89.3 FM from 4 to 6 p.m.
Get over it, girl. What's done is done. When you lost a good man, I sure found one. The way you treated him.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
My backyard.
Oh, your backyard. Try telling a bear that.
I did, and this bear talked back.
Talking bear, that's rich.
No, wait, it was Smokey Bear.
Smokey?
Why didn't you say so?
I did say so.
Continue.
I was burning yard waste.
No, boy.
He told me to burn legally and responsibly, and to remember that if it's too hot to touch, it's too hot to leave.
And as always, he's right. You know, 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
Yeah, I know that now.
Thanks to me.
Actually, thanks to Smokey.
As usual, the talking bear gets all the credit. Get your Smokey on. Always burn responsibly and contact your local fire department for open burning regulations. Because 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, I thought you and the boys were doing some environmental cleanup thing today.
We are.
Well, it looks more like you're going fishing.
We are.
And that's the example you're setting for our children.
Uh-huh.
Conservation is easy. Every time you purchase a fishing license or register your boat, you're helping to preserve our nation's coastlines, lakes, rivers, and streams, protecting memories for generations to come. To learn about all the ways your participation in boating and fishing help the environment, visit takemefishing.org/conservation.
Hi, this is Eliza Gilkison, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Broadcasting independent music since 1985.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Beverly Trout. Beverly is an Iowa native, and for the past 20 years, has focused on investigations into UFO sightings, abductions, anomalous crop formations, and landing traces. And after joining MUFON in 1991, she has served as a field investigator, a state section director, and was appointed state director for Iowa in 1995. And since retiring, Mrs. Trout has been a part-time dance instructor. In the past, she has refrained from revealing her own abduction encounters. And only during the past few years has she begun to speak out about her experiences to the general public. Beverly has lectured all over the country and has been interviewed on numerous TV and radio shows. And we're happy to have her with us on the line. Hello, Beverly.
Hello. Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you here. How are you today?
Well, I think I'm doing fine. Looking forward to our conversation.
Very good. Shall we get started? Let's start with the crop formations in Iowa. Have there been any genuine formations recently?
We have not had any reports recently. We recognize that does not necessarily mean that there have not been some crop formations in Iowa, because farmers in Iowa seem to be a bit reticent, a little hesitant to report them. Mm. And the reason I make that statement is that back in 1996, we had a rather prominent farmer in the Nevada, Iowa area who had two crop formations, and he was approached following divulging what had happened in his fields. He was approached by several other farmers who said to him, "We've had these in our fields too, but we just didn't tell anybody."
Huh. Why is that, do you think?
Well, you know, it's hard to say specific situations, but generally speaking, it's been my experience that when humans are placed in situations of rather high strangeness, some just simply want to sort of shut it away and not deal with it directly by reporting it, you know, to someone who may be able to discover some anomaly or not about what they find in their fields.
Right.
And so you have a kind of a, I have a kind of a fear factor that enters into some of these things.
Mm. Afraid of ridicule?
And that too, of course. Now, of course, MUFON, that I've been representing for the last 20 years, does not reveal witness identity. So even if someone had it, as long as others did not discover that they had it, perhaps accidentally, MUFON certainly would not reveal that.
Right. But, you know, these farmers kind of keep an eye on each other. Wouldn't it, you know, wouldn't it be kind of strange, or wouldn't a neighbor see an investigative team or a bunch of new people showing up at Farmer Jones' farm next door here and wonder what's going on?
You raise a good point. There is that about it. Sometimes, of course, these things appear somewhat far into the field.
Right.
And might not be discovered, you know, unless someone revealed that it was there.
Mm.
But you certainly raise a good point about the possibility of discovery.
Well, a lot of times small planes will be going overhead or what have you, and they'll see these crop formations. They'll notice them. They pretty much stand out. They look three-dimensional from the air, the genuine ones. You know, and then they'll investigate, they'll report it, they'll find out whose property that is, whose farm that is, what have you. But there's all kind of ways of discovering. And then and other times, the farmer will be accused of having made this thing. So, you know, and then they'd be accused of hoaxing.
It has the possibility for pitfalls for the farmer, certainly. And, of course, if we do get called in to check out these crop formations, it's up to us to try to discover if there really is something anomalous about it, and as best we can present whenever we are given an opportunity any anomalies associated with it, so that the ridicule factor can be diminished and so on.
Mm-hmm. Of course, to the skeptic, there's always a ridicule factor.
Always. That's usually because the skeptic doesn't necessarily check into in any depth,
right,
or at least the depth to which discoveries might be made.
Mm.
You know, what they want to think, they usually want to think.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't, I'm not tarnishing skepticism itself. What I'm really pointing to is debunkers who won't look, of course.
Right. Like Stanton Friedman says, "My mind's made up, don't confuse me with the facts," right?
There you go. Stanton does say it very well.
Yeah. So how are you able to determine the genuine crop formation from the hoaxed man-made ones?
Well, of course, the first thing that we look for is the position of the plants, for instance. If it's at harvest time the plants, therefore, should be somewhat dry or drier than they would be, of course, than in the growing season, you're going to look and see if, you know, if they're mashed down to the ground and so on and unbroken. This is one of the first things that we look at.
So if they're mashed down to the ground and broken, the plants are broken, does that determine the hoax factor?
Well, you'd certainly look at whether or not it was human-generated rather than, being an anomaly that we can't quite explain. I've been asked at various times, what are these crop formations? And, the best I can say is if they're genuine, if they appear to be genuine, they're an anomaly. And, unless someone has actually witnessed formation being formed by some sort of a vehicle in the air or whatever, I'm not going to go around saying that I know that a UFO made that formation.
Right.
I'm not going to go around saying that I don't know, that I would think that they would not have made it either, as far as that goes. It's just simply that we're faced with an anomaly, and we have to recognize that, and we have to take the samples and send them, to a lab for analysis and see what can be deduced from that process. But there are so many facets to the UFO phenomenon and that's, of course, is only one.
Are we still using my buddy W.C. Lovingood's facilities?
I haven't been in touch because we haven't had any recent formations in Iowa that have been reported, that is.
Okay.
And so I have not remained in touch to know whether or not W.C. Lovingood is still active.
Yeah.
I'm sure Nancy Talbot has her website, and that might reveal who is involved in that now. I just haven't had a need to check that out recently.
All right. Well, I know Lovingood. He's a good man, but he's getting on in years, and yet he gets up early in the morning. He gets up like 2 o'clock in the morning. He gets up 2:30 in the morning and goes to his laboratory, and that's his world. That's his life, and God bless him for that. But what can I say? I hope he's still doing that. Because
He's very focused, and I've talked with him a number of times in past years, but just simply not recently.
He told me he goes to bed at 8 o'clock at night and gets up at 2:30 in the morning. And, of course, my response is, why? Well, that's a long story.
That's that focus that comes into play in people's lives when they have a passion of sorts. And, of course...
Yeah.
Now, when you get into the UFO phenomenon, there can be a really focused component to it because, of course, there are so many questions, and with every partial answer that we think we get, we have to recognize that there are further questions embedded in the partial answers.
Right.
So,
right.
Here we go. It's a continuing thing.
Right.
My thing, over the years, too, in addition to the sightings and that sort of thing, have been abduction cases. And, of course, we've had many here in Iowa. I have some currently. And, of course, I have my own experience in that realm. This is something that, frankly, is keeping us very busy at the present time.
Right. I want to get into that a little bit later, but I wanted to ask you a couple questions further on the crop formations. What type of crops do you frequently find formations?
Well, here in Iowa, there are a lot of corn and beans raised.
Right.
And so in 1996 in the Nevada area that I referred to previously, this was in a soybean field at maturity. So this soybean field, the farmer was combining and discovered this formation and had the presence of mind to stop and not destroy it. And soybeans can be combined up to, say, 14-15% moisture. As it happened, this particular field was being combined at, I think, something over 10%, which means that all you had to do was walk in that field, and you know, you could take a couple of take your hand and touch those stems, and you could hear them sort of snap because it was so dry. If you simply bent the plant, and this was laid flat to the ground, you know, those plants unbroken, those stems unbroken. So it was quite obvious from the very first that we were dealing with something that was an anomaly.
Yeah.
And, you know, the testing, of course, took place and it bore it out, you know, this sort of thing.
Was the soil affected in any way?
You know, there was some differences in the growth in the following year in an adjoining field, by the way, in a cornfield at harvest. Same farmer. And we did discover that there was some really outlandish growth which was then planted in the next year to soybeans. In other words, we had a soybean formation at harvest, and then a couple of weeks later, in the adjoining field of corn, we had another formation. Then, in the following year, in that corn formation field, we had the differences in growth. And I wish I had my notes with me, because I could tell you the various percentages and so on if I had that, but I don't have it before me.
But it must be pretty difficult to hoax a formation in a cornfield. The stalks are so thick. You know, can you imagine a guy with a board and a rope and trying to push this corn down? Maybe
I wouldn't want to try it.
Maybe in wheat. Wheat would be easy, I would think. Although I've seen him try to hoax a formation in wheat. And once you get started, it becomes so thick, you can't really mash it down.
I certainly, I've heard various estimates by researchers. And, you know, they may have very good reasons for saying that they think most of it is hoax. You know, it seems to me that there are so many formations that really show such sophistication, such complexity, that I sometimes doubt the high percentages that I hear sometimes referred to.
Yeah. Well, what about the corn stalks, though? The formation that was in that field of corn, were the stalks broken? Were they laid down? Same as wheat?
No, they were laid down. But here's what also happened, because we couldn't get a full picture of it. And by the way, it was in kind of a teardrop formation. Don't know why, but that's just the way it shaped up. The farmer himself was not on the combine that day. In fact, there were two combines in the field. And he had hired those combines to come in. And when they came upon the formation, they went right on through in the cornfield. And later I was talking with the driver of one of the combines and with the operator, and he said, you know, he said, I thought afterwards, maybe I shouldn't have done that. And, of course, I'm on the other end of the line thinking, no, we wish you had not done that. Nevertheless, there were, you know, plant and soil samples that were sent into the lab, and you know there was a high amount of magnetic particles per gram of soil, that sort of thing, far above the normal average. So it's an interesting thing.
It said there are little metal balls, tiny metal balls or magnetic balls in
some... Yeah, it's magnetic particles, yeah.
And what is that all about?
Understanding.
What is that all about?
You know, it's above normal, and apparently, you know, it comes down, you know, in our atmosphere, and somehow or other, when these, or at least it's been the case here in Iowa, when these formations are generated, that you get this great increase per gram of soil. And so, you know, hey, just another question mark, you know.
Yeah. But these little magnetic balls come down normally? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, there is a normal concentration. Okay. And if I had my notes in front of me from that file, I could tell you what the norm is. Mm. But it's greatly increased, formations.
You mentioned earlier people saying, I saw a UFO make this, they don't want to say, I saw a UFO make this formation. Have you ever had that report where somebody said, and I saw this craft right above it, shining a light down, or the night before, or whatever? Have you ever had a connection between UFOs and the crop formations?
No, we really haven't.
Really?
It wasn't witnessed, as far as we know.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was, sometimes you don't know the exact... sometimes they aren't discovered for a day or two.
Right.
After they've been made. And so if somebody comes forward and says, well, I saw a UFO two or three nights ago, you know, they may want to think that they saw one in that area, and they may be right, and it could have been that made the formation, but we're not going to say that happened because we cannot know.
No.
We're being very careful there. We don't want to make a claim that's not backed up by a direct witnessing of the happening at the moment it took place.
That's
and
right.
Knowing that it took place at the moment that you have a sighting of something above a field.
Yeah, well, that's responsible of you, I'll say. So I need to take just a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, station making waves here out of Henry Ford Community College in lovely downtown Dearborn, Michigan. And it's 89.3 FM on your radio and WHFR.FM on your computer. So tune us in all over the world. My goodness, we're going out all over the world. That scares me. Anyway, what would you say was the most well-documented and convincing UFO sighting case in Iowa that you've worked on, or even that you haven't worked on, but you know that you know about?
Well, you know, a lot of the time, most of the time, actually, when we go out on investigations, we are depending on what the witness tells us,
mm-hmm.
and we've had a number of things in Iowa occur, and we still are. As a matter of fact, we're having something of an explosion of sightings right now. It's just been an avalanche within the last month or 6 weeks.
Really?
Yes. And so, you know, I can refer to cases in which screen memory is a big factor,
mm-hmm.
Along with usually an inappropriate response to that screen memory.
Tell us, what do you mean by screen
memory? There have been sightings at low level. For instance, we just had one 2 weeks ago last Sunday night on the 17th of June.
Mm.
A woman cleaning her swimming pool between 10 and 11 at night, and something that appears to have been quite sizable. Approached very quietly, no noise, from the west, headed east, and huge, in her description, huge red lights. She thinks the apparent size, not the actual, but the apparent size was about 4 feet in diameter. She likens it to the size of her coffee table that she has out on her patio. And these lights were, it's as if she's looking up underneath the object at about 60 degrees, she thinks, and that these lights are forming a square. Now, whether or not it was on the bottom of a round object or some other shape, who knows? Maybe it was a square. Anyway, she races to the patio door. The husband, she yells at him. Then she regrets that she even turned her back, because when she turns back to look again, there's now one red light east of her, and both she and her husband watch as this one red light accelerates some, but still it's not going very fast, and then suddenly shoots straight up in the air.
Wow.
And is gone super fast, from their sight. The whole thing only having taken maybe about 25 seconds.
Gee.
And so you've got this thing, kind of thing going on, but then you've got, cases in Iowa where over Highway 30, for instance, in the Ames, Iowa area, which is the town where Iowa State University is located, you've got a witness from Colorado, an engineer, as it happens, a female engineer who had a sleeping passenger with her in her van. She was eastbound on Highway 30 at the west edge of Ames, and about 3:30 in the morning, and this was last September 9, and she hears a bit of a sound, and she likens it to a kind of a whoop rumble. And at this point, she's looking through her windshield, sees a huge object. She can't even see the end of it off the south side of the four-lane highway. And she begins to pound on her sleeping passenger arm and yell at him and cannot wake him up.
Oh, really?
And then she also sees that there's a pickup truck ahead of her that's begun to swerve in and out on the highway. So her conclusion is that probably that driver has also seen this object. And that particular driver in the pickup truck pulled over on the side of the highway and stopped. However, she kept on going, and she's watching then as the object, this, by the way, rectangular object, without any sound whatsoever, departs from the area. And, of course, she did not stop and talk to the driver of the pickup truck. Now, you know, there seems to have been some really interesting things happening as far as I, as an investigator, can tell during that particular incident. Number one, why couldn't she wake up her sleeping passenger?
Right.
You know, about 30 minutes later, when she's telling him what had happened, he's turning to her and saying, well, why didn't you wake me up? And so, you know, in my speculation, I'm looking at the possibility that there could have been a main event even before she had the sighting. Why? Because apparently there was some kind of a control process in play,
right,
which prevented her sleeping passenger from being aroused.
Yeah.
And that, to me, indicates that something had already probably taken place. Now, that's speculation on my part, but as a investigator, I think it's appropriate to make that speculation.
So you think perhaps she was abducted and her friend was switched off, so to speak?
I think that's a strong possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And, these aliens, if they want to be seen, they're going to be seen. Mm-hmm. If they don't want to be seen, they're not going to be seen, whether it's themselves as individuals or whether it's their vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fact that there was sound in this particular case, sound is very rare in sightings.
Right.
Once in a while it happens, but, you know, very rare. And, of course, when it departed, there was no sound whatsoever.
Hmm.
So it does not appear the sound was a requirement for the vehicle itself.
So did she watch it depart?
Yeah, she saw it depart, and of course it departed pretty fast, and it departed silently, and she proceeded slowly on down the highway, but did not stop.
Did she notice any missing time?
No, you see, according to her, she doesn't know of any missing time, not that that's necessarily something that a witness would recognize, unless they have, you know, checked the time before and checked the time after and that sort of thing.
Right.
So I can only speculate that there may have been something prior.
Yeah, and, you know, I've heard of cases, you know, that's weird enough where you know, I looked at my watch and it was 1 o'clock, and then what I thought was 10 minutes has passed, and it was actually 3 o'clock, and that happens. But I have heard of cases where they gain time. They look at their watches.
And I am not above Let me cite another case. In June of 2010, near a small town east of Des Moines, this was on a Saturday morning at about 11:30 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
A mother and daughter, the daughter is 31, the mother is 61, they were eastbound on Interstate 80. And this speaks to your time point, and I think it is an interesting point to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
They had just crossed the river bridge. The daughter's driving. She's got the car set on cruise control. And keep in mind that the car was never taken off cruise control.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, the daughter admits that she's a fast driver. She sets it at 70 plus. She actually indicates that she goes nearer to 80, but I always say 70 plus.
And, just in case
so
a cop's listening.
Across
right?
this bridge, she sees some sort of a reflection. She thinks about a quarter of a mile ahead of her. And she's wearing her sunglasses, but still there's this bright thing that seems to catch her attention. And she calls this to the attention of her mother, and her mother looks up. At this point, and at the point at which the mother looks up, the object is at the fender, the front fender of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the car has never stopped. It's never been taken off of cruise control. And so then the object comes around to the passenger door side, and the mother says that if she had rolled down her window and put her hand out, she could have touched it. Mm-hmm. What it was a small object, which is estimated about 12 inches in diameter, with a couple of protrusions, one at each end, so to speak, of this kind of, you know, round-looking 12-inch diameter object, a small UFO. Now, what's interesting about the time factor is we cannot come up with any missing time for this mother and daughter. They know about when they were at that point on Interstate 80. They also know they were headed toward eastern Iowa. They know the time they arrived and so on. However, the mother, during the sighting, keeping in mind that the car never stopped, this object at the passenger door, just outside the passenger door, made a right-angle turn and moved off Interstate 80 to the south side of the highway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while the mother had it by the door, she says that she saw it rotate many times. And I, you know, pinned her down on this, and she said, I saw it rotate many times, and it did not change its equilibrium. It maintained a stable, you know, sort of a rotation.
Right.
And so, you know, you have to wonder, given her, and she said it seemed as if it just went on, and yet that car never stopped, and this small object was gone from that door, the passenger side door, in just a matter of maybe a few seconds. Hmm. Now, that's our linear time we're talking about,
right.
So who knows what actually was going on there.
Right.
It seems to me that there may have been some sort of, who knows what, speculate on some kind of time alteration.
Right.
And you've certainly pointed to those possibilities. And
right.
I know that this has been a case that we've been rather fascinated by because of this angle of it. Small UFO certainly did some very anomalous things.
Mm.
And the mother certainly thought that she was in the midst of a longer term sighting than what actually was taking place.
Right. So it's like even in the same car, mother and daughter, a passenger and driver, are in different time zones in the presence or in the proximity of something anomalous like this, right?
That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Very interesting point that you've made.
Right.
And, you know, it's an interesting thing. You know, you have any number of strange cases. For instance, screen memories. And when I talk about screen memories, whether it's before a group or whether it's in the class I teach in the adult ed two or three times a year for the Des Moines School District, you know, I say that when they're alien-generated, it's as if you're being presented, you, the witness, are being presented with something totally ordinary, but it's wrapped in a bizarre context.
Mm-hmm.
And some examples of that. In 2003, and I did not learn about this until last fall, because I had participants in my UFO class who came and related this to me. A man and his girlfriend over the 4th of July in 2003 were on their way back from Minnesota on a north-south highway out west of Des Moines, and about 2:30 in the morning, onto the highway comes a deer. Well, they avoided hitting the deer, so that was a good outcome, and they proceeded on, and about two more miles down the highway, there is an ambulance sitting in the middle of the highway. The passenger door is closed on the ambulance. The driver's door is open. The headlights of the ambulance are on. The taillights are on. Also, the light that lights up an area when there is an emergency to be worked at night was on. There was no one in the ambulance. The rear doors were open. There was no one around the ambulance. There was no emergency to be worked. You simply had the ambulance sitting there with the lights on, doors open, and in the middle of the highway, and nothing to explain its presence.
That's what they saw.
That's what they saw. Mm-hmm. That's what they were presented with, at least.
Mm-hmm.
They proceeded on down, you know, they made their way rather slowly around the ambulance since it's sitting in the middle of the highway, and they went on down the highway another couple of miles, and then saw what appeared to be a man standing by the side of the road with his back to the highway, unmoving, did not move. There was no vehicle around to explain his presence. He was engaged in no activity that would explain his stance. There were no farm buildings nearby to explain why he would be out there at, you know, at that time of the morning, in the middle of the night. And at this point, the driver is saying, do you think we ought to stop? And the girlfriend is saying, no, no, drive on by. And so that's precisely what they did. Now, you know, you could look at these three incidents in that four-mile area, first the deer, then the ambulance, then the man. And you might say, well, there are a lot of deer in Iowa. That could be ordinary enough. But when you add in the ambulance and the man, then, you know, I have to speculate that it's okay to bring the deer back into the equation. It seems to me that this was certainly a screen memory of some sort.
Yeah.
And of course, there are other incidents of screen memory. I was particularly interested in an article in the MUFON Journal last January in which the investigators were relating an incident in a small town in Arizona where when this lady was on her way home from work, I believe from Flagstaff to her hometown in the middle of the night and had seen a couple of anomalous lights. What caught my further attention was that when she pulled into her home driveway, there sat a 37-inch rabbit
37
on the driveway, unmoving, and, you know, measured by how it compared to the size of her the hood of her car and so on.
All right, right.
We also had a an incident in Des Moines in 2008. And I happen to know this particular witness, and so I have some, you know, really good sense of the integrity of this person. She is a cat lover. And keeping in mind that, you know, that's her focus. She has several cats. She's focused on cats. This is a big factor in what I'm going to relate. So in the middle of the night, of course, the cats are in her bedroom, and she's awakened by hearing the cats make some sort of a sound. They were over at the window as if they were looking out over her backyard. So she gets out of bed. She goes over to the window, and she sees three raccoons that are chasing a cat across her backyard.
Hmm.
Now, the cat leaps up on the roof because it would have been fairly simple to do that. And with the pitch of the roof the way it was, soon lost to view. Well, the raccoons, simply as if they were walking horizontally, walked vertically up the side of the garage and disappeared over the pitch of the roof. Well, the witness is so disturbed by all this because her thinking is focused. It's centered. It's almost, you know, obsessed by the idea that these raccoons are going to kill that cat.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a walk-in closet next to her bedroom, and it looks out over her driveway that leads up to the garage. So she goes into that walk-in closet. It has a window. She's able to look out over the driveway. And to her great relief, the cat is now sauntering down the driveway and obviously has gotten away.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, she's visiting with a friend, and she's relating this incident to the friend. And for some reason, the friend said, "Well, how big were those raccoons?" And she said, instantly, she said, "As big as bears."
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're not talking about baby bears.
Mm-hmm.
To her, you know, and it was as if at that instant when she was asked that question, it suddenly dawned on her that, of course, raccoons can't be as big as bears.
And they can't walk vertically up the side of a wall.
Right. They're pretty nimble, but not quite that. Now, you know, you ask yourself, you know, why was this presented to her?
Right.
And, you know, I can at least consider that there may have been some element of alien consideration. And, I've had other screen memory cases where I've considered this. You know, it's as if perhaps the UFO occupants want us to know there's interaction. But by presenting this so as to gain a delayed reaction from the witness,
right,
it's as if almost they're trying to not overwhelm the witness.
Right, right. Because if they presented themselves as they were, it would be total shock.
Yeah. That's the angle. And I do think. And, of course, then, you know, mingled in with these screen memories, you get this inappropriate response.
Hmm.
I've had experience in my own case.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the incident with the deer and the ambulance and the man, you know, that was an inappropriate response. They didn't stop to ask that man by the side of the road, did he need help? And,
mm-hmm.
you know, this sort of thing.
Right.
It's just seems to be a rather common thing to get an inappropriate response. You know, my agenda as an investigator, obviously we're out on the front lines for more than one reason.
Right.
Some investigators would say, number one, we're there to gather information regarding these sightings and encounters.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there is no doubt but what we need to assess the credibility of the witness. But, you know, I would add something about the witnesses. I feel a great responsibility to speak to the needs of witnesses.
Mm, yes.
Witnesses need to dialogue with those of us who at least have some familiarity with the UFO phenomenon. And, you know, even if they've only seen what might be labeled as a light in the sky,
mm-hmm.
if they think that it's totally anomalous, that it's strange, they still need to talk to someone because,
right.
you know, too often this represents a paradigm shift
mm-hmm.
to witnesses, and they may have a set of beliefs which lead them to react in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
I always when I'm in dialogue with witnesses, mentioned it's useful to don't deify this phenomenon and don't demonize it.
That's it.
To do so simply destroys credibility.
Right.
Now, in judging the credibility of witnesses, I also recognize that as an investigator, you know, I don't know of any other way except to make a judgment call.
Mm-hmm.
As investigators, we're the last people who want to be scammed regarding UFOs.
Yeah, but often we are.
Well, and that certainly can happen.
Right.
And the other thing, I guess I could call this my agenda as an investigator, is to recognize markers which might indicate that there's interaction, that there's, you know, the word that's bandied about is abduction, of course.
Right.
Even though the witness may not have conscious memory.
Right.
And, for instance, I did a case last fall in a suburb of Des Moines. A young woman, a triangle, had come within about 50 feet of her and then passed over the car. It was still daylight. Come to find out, when I interviewed her and met with her, she had had another previous close-up sighting in her hometown a couple of years before that.
Uh-huh.
And then, toward the end of the interview, you see, finally, she comes forth with the information that there had been an incident in her bedroom of an entity that sounded to me as if it represented an alien individual.
Right.
And so, you know, to get into a in-depth dialogue with witnesses, it seems to me, is called for. I was reminding myself today of a case, a very famous case I'm sure you're familiar with, and all of your listeners probably. Back in the 70s, Captain Coyne, with a helicopter in Ohio, near Mansfield, Ohio, and so on, of a UFO. Right. And this was reported even to the Pentagon. And it's interesting for me to consider that even the Pentagon had the information at their disposal which led them to question those men on that helicopter as to whether or not they had some dreams that needed to be looked at.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, it's quite a thing.
Right.
Yeah, you know, there's no fun and games, as far as I can tell, to this abduction phenomenon, and certainly I don't find that in my case. Mm-hmm. I don't find it in other people's cases. When I'm meeting with witnesses, whether it's just on a sighting or whether it's on abduction, to me, I want to calm the witnesses down.
That's right, yeah.
And I feel the same when I'm speaking to general public audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And when I speak to general public audiences, whether it's a community group, whether it's a church group, whether it's a businessmen's group, what I find is absolutely intense interest in this subject. In fact, there have been times when I've gone into speaking situations where I was anticipating that they would be very, perhaps anti, you know, simply would not be in agreement or willing to listen to the UFO subject. And what I have found is vastly different.
Wow, that's great. That's great. I need to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM. The only station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Beverly Trout, UFO investigator, and also a abductee as well. We're kind of running out of time. We've got about 10 minutes left, but I wanted to ask you, Beverly, about your own abduction experiences. When did this begin with you?
Well, in 1993, I knew that I had had some very suggestive dreams, and we'd had some incidents at the farm that were somewhat questionable.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, in 1993, I had some hypnosis sessions with a psychiatrist in Iowa who was very familiar with the abduction phenomenon. That was Dr. Gray Woodman. And I had seven sessions with him, but I have had conscious encounters as well.
Conscious encounters.
Yes. And of course, my aim was, for goodness sakes, don't lead me in hypnosis. By the way, I never recommend hypnosis to witnesses.
Why is that?
If they bring up the subject, then I say to them, I never, I never recommend this, but if you feel that you're able to handle whatever you find out in a hypnosis session, that's fine. I'll see, I'll contact a certified hypnotist and see what can be arranged. As a matter of fact, we have a case now in southern Iowa, and I'm sure you're probably familiar with the work of Craig Lang from Minneapolis.
Right.
He's written a book, and he's done these hypnosis sessions with people for years and years now, and has done considerable amount of speaking. He's coming down into Iowa and going to interact with one of my witnesses later this month. So I certainly thank him. He's doing this on a pro bono basis. This is a very a family of very little means, and he has simply been willing to do this. Right. At any rate, I never recommend it.
Right.
It's simply that I will certainly facilitate it if a witness wants to do this.
Well, how did this help in your case, or did it help in your case, hypnosis?
Yes, it did. I reported things that I would never have thought of, and consciously, an incident, for instance, when I was at puberty. Oh, by the way, you had asked how early this began. The hypnosis session seemed to indicate that this has been going on since I was a very young child.
Okay.
And, given my advanced age, I am a senior citizen. This goes back into the 1930s.
Okay.
So this is nothing new and, has just been a lifelong thing.
Okay.
The Hayfield incident, for instance, when I was at puberty, apparently, from what I could tell in the hypnosis session, involved some swelling of my brain, and my perception was that they went in to the brain and saw the cause of the problem and inserted a tiny coil to fix it, and then put me back in the hayfield and so on. Now, on that occasion, what I'm perceiving in the hypnosis session is that there was a reptilian in charge of a team of grays, which in itself was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And so, you have apparently at least this kind of collaboration of sorts.
The reptilians are always portrayed to be the bad guys.
Yeah, and I don't, I'm always very hesitant to, I don't like to see the reptilians given a bad rap, so to speak. That's not to say that there cannot be rogues in every group.
Right, right.
And I have no doubt, you and I can walk down the street and we could meet some human rogues very quickly.
Really? All too often.
Right, exactly. Something you might be interested, a friend of mine, and he's now deceased, but he called me up after this happened. This was about 1996 or 1997. I'll call him Ken. He had been back in the Boston area, and this speaks to the reptilian presence on our planet. He was in the waiting area getting, waiting to get on the plane back to Des Moines. And Ken was a pretty good remote viewer and pretty hard-headed about the whole thing, very psychic. I've seen him, sat at a restaurant and seen him scan the person next to him if he wasn't acquainted with him and that sort of thing. He was just, very gifted and psychic and so on. At any rate, he's just idly looking over the crowd. And so when they boarded the plane, Ken, and I'm not surprised that he did this, knowing him the way I did, he walks clear to the back of the airplane, sits right down in the back row, and then is watching other people get on the plane. He's looking at a business type, tall individual, well-dressed, putting his briefcase and so on up into the overhead, and suddenly Ken realizes that the individual is a reptilian. And the instant he realizes it, the individual looks clear to the back of the plane at Ken, and Ken forgot until the next day when he was in the supermarket with his wife what he had been able to perceive.
Wow.
So I think, you know, there's quite a presence, obviously, and...
So they're here among us is what you're saying.
I'm pretty well convinced of that. I don't think there's any doubt. You know, there's... there are hybrids, I'm sure, and there may be actually aliens themselves who are able to somehow appear in human form, you know, and that sort of thing.
It bothers me to think that I'm curious. I've never heard of a reptilian being. I've heard of what we call the Nordics could look like us, very fine-featured and beautiful people. But and they could appear like us, but not the reptilians. How do they appear like us?
Yeah, good question.
Or do they give us a screen memory?
Yeah, well, you know, who knows? And but I had to take Ken pretty seriously because I knew his capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it just has always resonated with me. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I've deduced. When it comes to this business of investigation, is that it's well for investigators to understand the difference between the paranormal and alien activity.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be an overlap sometimes. Years ago, I read the account on Betty, Andreas, and Luca. You know, the investigator was Raymond Fowler on her cases, and I, as I recall. She related some out-of-body abduction and so on.
Yes.
I recently, about 5 years ago, I met an abductee, and this was a gentleman. He was also interested in the paranormal. And in relating something that had occurred with he and another gentleman, when they were abducted and placed within a group of other humans, and they were standing up, and his thing, his incident was, he said, you know, I allowed my ego to get away with me. Hmm. And he said, I turned to this alien, and I said, I help people go out of their body. And he said, the alien touched him, deliberately put him out of the body on the spot.
Oh, my. In other words, me too.
Always, you know, this is a gentleman who would not lightly make a statement like this. I was very impressed with his ability to be humble enough to relate this, you know.
Right.
The other thing I've noticed about abductions is, you know, in interacting with abductees and also assessing my own state of mind, there's quite a dichotomy, it seems to me. You know, here we are somewhat repulsed. And on the other hand, we as abductees are also fascinated.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, and I'm not proud of saying this, frankly, we don't quite want the aliens to go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that. In other words, I've heard that, yeah, I think I have, some people say, I think I've had an implant somewhere in my body, but you know what? I don't want to have it taken out.
Yes.
I would feel, and when they do have it taken out, or if they should have it taken out, they feel like they've lost a part of themselves, you know?
Yes.
And I just think.
They're not willing to.
Right.
Well, and really.
They become part of the family, in other words, you know?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And I'm not proud of that. You know, I've been asked, well, hey, didn't you sign up for this? And, and I have to say, well, Maybe I did. Maybe I was out to lunch that day.
Or in a previous life.
But, I may have. And we all know that there's a great degree of manipulation on the part of the aliens. There's a control process every time I have been, and, you know, I've been approached on a conscious level several times. And, you know, it's like this control process, it governs my mental and emotional processes. I'm very conscious, but yet, you know, I'm only functioning within a certain range of mental and emotional processes. It may be a little bit like a governor on a vehicle.
Yeah. Beverly,
you know, that controls the energy output.
Right.
And it's always been obvious to me that there is an alien consciousness technology, as well as, you know, a physical mechanical technology that they possess.
Right.
And and so, you know, it seems to me, you know, Ingo Swann back in the early 90s did an article in Fate magazine, and he said, you know, I'm paraphrasing obviously, he said, humans, you better develop your own consciousness technology.
Beverly Trout.
This seems to be the common ground upon which aliens and humans can meet.
Right. We're running very short on time, but Beverly, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I hope we can do this again sometime.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And if listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on the forum button on the webpage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, UFOImplications.com. As please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m., when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
WHFR, Dearborn.
Oil and gasoline prices are going through the roof.
Tell me about it. I can't afford to drive to the grocery store.
We've reached the tipping point, so I'm going to give you some tips that could save you hundreds of dollars a year on gas.
Tipping point? I've reached my clipping point. I feel like Ellen Scissorhands clipping all those coupons.
Tip number one. Keep your tires properly inflated. You could save enough money to buy a gallon of orange juice every month.
Can do.
Tip number two. Driving 60 instead of 70 on highways and not racing around town can buy you bacon and eggs every day.
Wow!
Tip number three. Cut the idling, lower the AC, and ditch the junk in the trunk. That could buy you bread and butter, and maybe some grits.
You mean by driving smarter, I can eat breakfast free for a year? Wow!
For more wow tips for your pocketbook and the planet, go to the Alliance to Save Energy's website, drivesmarterchallenge.org.